Welcome to Waking Up in America with Valerie Kirkgaard. All comments, views, and opinions expressed on this show are solely those of Valerie, her guests, and callers. Now here's your host, Valerie Kirkgaard.
This is for you. This is for you and me, and who we see when we see each other. This is for all. This is for all the time you tried to find your sister or your brother. And you're not crazy anymore. You've been waiting at the door. And it's time to open.
Oh, yes, 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 yes. Good morning, you American state nationals. You are listening to Waking Up in America, dynamic radio dialogues brought to you by Key Media, happily200.hghbreakthrough.com. Once again, happily200.hghbreakthrough.com. One of the most important website directions you'll ever receive. Go over there and find out how to reverse aging. Go to Bragg, BRAGG.com, and find out what our friend Patricia is doing, and check out happily200.com, the possibility of living to be 200 years old. TheCodingCompany.com, Sir Jason Winterty, DrValerie.com, and Doctor is all spelled out. The Body Can and Jason on Hair are all here to serve you. Bob Sercosta of the Home Shopping Network says we're doing radio that's changing the world. We love that endorsement, Bob. Hear a telephone ringing, a dog barking, an angel or an ET singing. We call in from our homes and offices around the galaxy to create this program. Now, Jesus spoke in Aramaic, and in the Lord's Prayer, pray means to go out into the world and get that which is yours. So always celebrate and include a prayer for the celebration of our republic, for the United States, for America. And that's F-O-R, America, the men, women, and children who represent and serve our great nation and our animal friends, as well as each other in our communities. Our program is dedicated to happily200.com and happily200.thrivehgh.com, the possibility of living a quality life, being of service, and living in the fifth dimension. Our nation is structured in Christian values, the Ten Commandments work, guys. We bow our heads in appreciation for the men and women who risk their lives and fortunes for our future. If you have questions while we're on air, tweet Randy, and that's Randy with an I, R-A-N-D-I, at Randy Shannon, and that's Shannon with two N's. Follow me on Twitter at Val Kirkgaard 1, and that's Kirkgaard with two A's. But give you some names to remember here. Our guests today are Ellen Brown and Ken Doss. I don't exactly know what to call the topic of what we're talking about today, because basically these two are experts at putting on deep hip boots and waiting around in banking terms. And there's a word for it, but I don't even know if you can spell it on here. And you put your hip boots on and start to wade with Ellen Brown and Ken Doss, because they're going to be telling you about the system. And I can hear Randy's ears all perked up, and Paul's in the background, and Sherry's here too. It's like, oh, my God. So...
Full House today.
America with Doctors Val Kirkgaard and Randy Shannon. Randy, any comments before we get started?
Well, I'm just excited because, you know, I kind of pulled out of the legality stuff quite some time ago. And when we were talking off air, it just sounded fascinating, all these things that are happening. And I'm proud of people standing. So as they get into the details about what's happening, it's just fascinating. I know humanity has it in them to stand and do what's right and what's good. So, and pulling away from some of the stuff that, like, our president, Donald Trump, is having to fight. So I'm happy to hear it. I'm excited to hear our guest today.
So I really think I'm really tempted to lead off with Ken, because Ken's going to tell us how the Queen of England is more closely tied to us than we realize. Aren't you, Ken?
Yes, yes, much more than I thought, much more than we ever thought. I thought we were in a free country, and here I find out that we're giving, our attorneys are giving our rights away to the English crown, and they're doing it through Merrill Lynch and doing it through the banks, and they're doing it through patents. And the point that I've come at this is from a different point than most people have. Most people are fighting this from a legal perspective, or trying to fight it from a legal perspective, as you yourself are. And we're finding it's not working. And about 10 years ago, I got into a different side of research and started looking into intellectual properties. And what I've ascertained after 10 years is a lot of paper. But what I found is that this whole system is operating on a system of patented processes and overlays of automated systems that runs through our government system, our banking system, our trading system, our credit system, everything, the whole system. And it's all linked together by programming, and it's all linked together by patented processes. And you know, you hear the arguments about banking and the Federal Reserve and what banking really is. And what I've discovered is banking is patents. It's a manipulation of information that is exploiting us. Two of the things that are enjoyed by a patent owner is they get to exploit the patent, and they get to exclude others from using it. Well, what they've done is they've incorporated our name into it, our signature into it, into all these wealth gain patents of Goldman Sachs and, you know, all these hedge funds and all these annuities, and they've used us as grantors and have used our credit, but then have stripped it away from us so that they can take it and pocket it and keep it off books and take it off shores and leave us as a debtor. And these are the things that people aren't aware of that I like to try to get known out there. And it's very hard to try to educate people on intellectual properties and patents, because it's a whole different area that is very sophisticated, and it was intentionally concealed from us.
How did the Queen of England get in on this?
Well, they've been there they've always been there by treaty and by letters patent and by sovereignty. And they've been here since they never left. They've never left. I have a patent from, which I have in front of me here. It is an assignment from Merrill Lynch Her Majesty's, I don't have it in front of me, but Her Majesty's British Crown. And it all has to do with DNA. It all has to do with DNA and fluids and signatures. And Merrill Lynch just went ahead and assigned it over a certain percentage to the Queen of England and the British Crown. And what they have is what they actually have on us is the ad valorem tax. So they have a land tax on us. So when people talk about all of, and I know Anna talks about this a lot, and Anna and I are very good friends, but she talks about the Vatican having control of us. The Vatican doesn't have control of us, not anymore, not since 2001 with UCC 9, when they were able to fractionalize us into, you know, take our whole person and cut us into 1,000 different slices and sell us off to 1,000 different players. So the Vatican doesn't have a slice of us anymore. They'd have a slice of us, but then 1,000 other people, hedge funds, banks, wealthy individuals have a piece of us. So they're all vying for us. And
let me ask you a question. Don't we have any rights of ownership? If we knew how to practice them, wouldn't we have a way of getting a percentage of this back or something?
Yes, we do, actually. What I'm working on right now is figuring out what that remedy is and what that relief is. And what they're getting away with is they're getting away with our signature, and they're doing it by an electronic means. So if you're in a court case and you're fighting in court and you go to revoke your signature or revoke the contract, they're going to ignore it. And the reason why they're ignoring it is because they've taken our handwritten signature and they've converted it to a digital signature. And we have to be, we're not in that system. We're not in this digital system of theirs, which is the bank system and the government system. And so what we have to do is we have to take back our signature. And to do that, we have to become born again, quote unquote, born again into the digital system. And to do that, we can do that through Treasury. And that's the good news here, is that we can take back our name and we can take back our accounts. So the idea here is to go into Treasury and say, okay, I'm here. I'm Ken Doss. I'm here. This is me. This birth certificate attaches to me. The all caps name attaches to me. I've got all these lines of business out there, and I want to consolidate these lines of business, I want to audit them, and I want to go into a trust, and I want to be protected by Treasury at this point in time in a shared copyright. We can't do that right now. There's no way we can do it in any state, because we're dealing with state laws and state codes and statutes, which I can show are all fixed. They're all fixed patented processes.
How do we do it?
Pardon me?
Have that much more time, cliffhanger. How do we get started on this mess here?
Well, we got started on this back in, starting about 1998 with State Street. There was a ruling, State Street versus Signature Financial Group. And the court, in its infinite wisdom, said, well, a business process is a patentable process because it produces a concrete and tangible result, which is it spit out result. The algorithmic program spit out results into a broker's hand. The broker could take to his investors and give them advice on how to invest. And the court said, being that this was a concrete and tangible result, and therefore automated business processes are patentable. Well, that just opened up the flood. Prior to 1998, there were only a handful of financial patents. Anna and I, in my last trip to Alaska, we estimated that since 1998, there's about 47,000 financial patents out there now. Bank of America's got 5,000 alone since 1998. That's one thing. The second thing is the revisions to UCC-9, which includes secured transactions, fractionalization, securitization, but under that also includes patents, copyrights, and trademarks, which means that for the first time they could take our person and slice us up into a million different slices and sell us off. And then the biggest thing was the OCC, the Office of the Comptroller Against Currency, deregulation and preemption in 2001, where they gave basically all our rights to banking and allowed them to operate with autonomy. And then they preempted any kind of consumer acts or protections to go after the banks. So they basically said, okay, well, here, we're going to give you your room. We're going to let you go ahead and do what you want to do. We're going to protect you. We're not going to have any consumers bother you or anybody bother you. And so what they basically did was they threw out all codes and statutes, and they left consumers standing there naked with the expectation that we were protected, with the expectation that we're consumers, with the expectation that we have RESPA in place and TILA in place. And then here we come to find out in 2008 when the economy collapses, we've got nothing. They're just ramrodding through us. So we're basically about 20 years now, they've got a head start on us. And what they did was they made us believe that it's business as usual, it's ordinary course, it's a mortgage loan, if it's a foreclosure, we can take the house away, but that's not what happened. What they did was they instituted this sophisticated system of trademark trading and patented processes that we have no idea even exist. And they intentionally concealed that from us so that we wouldn't know about it. And they put it over, the blanket that covers it is, oh, it's a mortgage loan. It's not a mortgage loan. There's no mortgage loans. What they did was they created the air illusion of a mortgage loan, but in fact what they're doing is they're creating a lease transaction to where they're taking our asset, capitalizing it, taking it off the books, and then leasing back the asset to us. So the old American dream, there is no American dream. The American dream of home ownership is a lease.
We're almost out of time for this segment. Tell people how you can get in touch with them, how they can get in touch with you. You're also on Facebook, aren't you?
Yes, I'm on Facebook. You can get a hold of me at Ken Dost, K-E-N, Dost, D-O-S-T. Also, Facebook page, mortgage equals copyright derivative. And a blog page called Dost Affixed Occasions. It's D-O-S-T-A-F-F-I-X-E-D-A-C-A-T-I-O-N-S. And the reason why it's named that, if I could, real quick, is they've taken our name and they've affixed it to labels and instruments that sophisticated processes. So I kind of put a slam in their face. Said, okay, well, DOS sophistications, you're affixing my name to sophisticated instruments, and now I've caught you because now I know what you're doing. So DOS sophistications. In other words,
okay.
We're sophisticated now to catch on what they've done.
Come back to you, I promise. You're too hard to walk away from. It's fascinating stuff that you're talking about. You're listening to Waking Up in America with Dr. Sal Kirkgaard and Randy Shannon. We thank happily200.com, Patricia and Paul Bragg's apple cider vinegar drinks, cleaningcompany.com, cleaning your eustachian tubes and handling your sinus issues. Follow the links on the site and educate yourselves on what is possible. The Galactic Federation and Sheldon and Colleen, drvalerie.com, happily200.com. The tip of the day is to find a way to be of service to neighborhood and community. And before we move on to Ellen Brown here, Randy, Paul, Sherry, anything in particular that you want to ask Ken that we can have answered in 2 minutes?
Well, one thing I want him to describe is he mentions UCC, and the listeners may not quite understand what that is. If he can give us that, and whoever sneezes if they want to mute when they do it, if he could just explain that real quick for the listeners, that would be great.
Well, UCC-9 is a uniform commercial code, and UCC-3 is a section that refers to negotiable instruments, so it would be a promissory note or a mortgage loan. UCC-9 is a section that deals with secure transactions in commerce, and we're all expected to be good merchants in commerce per the UCC. So the UCC is just a commercial code for business transactions and trade, and that's basically everything that's built, that's based on. There's no law. It's all law is commercial. It's all UCC.
Paul, do you have any questions?
No, I'm just listening with bated breath about the difficulties with electronic signatures. I've run into some certain issues in that area as well. Not personally, but the abuse of electronic signatures is rampant and it's going to get worse.
Yes,
I think we should go after
way out of hand.
Here's next week and have lots of fun here. I'm just delighted to have an old friend back here on Waking Up in America. Her name is Ellen Brown. If you're on her list, it's fascinating, all the different things. I had to ask Ellen which of the 7 things that she was on the top of her mind today. One of the things that came up was student debt. But I think what you said about the Los Angeles City Council pulling their money out of Wells Fargo and then not having any place to put it was cool. And Ellen, if you would tell people in America what was the first state they had public banking and what they accomplished with that that nobody else could accomplish, I'd just love to have you tell them that.
Right. Well, it's the Bank of North Dakota. It's the only state we have that has its own bank. Globally, actually in the 1970s, globally 50% of banks were publicly owned. And by the 1990s, it was 40%. Now it's down to 22%. But in the U.S., we have one. That's the Bank of North Dakota. And the reason I started following it was that after the 2008 collapse, North Dakota was the only state that didn't go into the red. And so I knew it was the only state that had its own bank, so I was, you know, watching it carefully. It also had the lowest foreclosure rate in the country, the lowest default rate, and it was just doing well in a number of ways. And it was before the oil boom, so it wasn't due to oil. And in fact, after the oil, well, in 2014, the Wall Street Journal came out with an article that said that the Bank of North Dakota was more profitable than Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan Chase. And so that was right before the oil bust. And then there was a huge oil collapse, which would have just did take down a number of oil states. But North Dakota remained standing, and their bank just kept every year for the last 12 years, I think, they've had record profits greater than the last year. So the oil bust did not take them down. In other words, their profits were not due to oil. It was due to their business model, which is just a very efficient model. In 1919, the farmers were losing their farms to big out-of-state banks, and so there was a big populist movement, which is exactly what I think we need again today, where they won an election. It was called the Nonpartisan League. Won an election, managed to get the governor in and set up this state-owned bank, and they also set up a state-owned granary so that they could handle all their business, basically, within the state. And it's just been going like gangbusters ever since. Well, actually, like gangbusters in the last maybe 20 years when they actually started doing more commercial-type lending. The model is that by law, all of the state's revenues are deposited in the bank. And then the bank does what all banks do, which is actually create loans on its books. That money reformers have been saying for a century that it's not governments that create money, it's banks. They create money when you take out a loan. Rather, like Ken was saying, it's they turn your signature or your promise to pay into a negotiable instrument, and that becomes money. It's really bank credit, but everybody accepts, when you write a check, everybody accepts that that check is for actual dollars when it's really just a promise to pay of the bank. You're actually swapping your IOU for the bank's IOU. So anyway, the Bank of North Dakota is doing what all banks do. But the profits go back to the people. They cut out the middleman. They don't have high-paid CEOs. They don't have shareholders sucking the profits out. So it's like a cooperative bank, or it's a people's bank owned by the people. The profits go back to the people, and as all banks do, they're able to leverage their funds. So instead of just having a revolving fund where, say, you've got $1 billion to start with and you lend that out at 3% and then you have to wait for it to come back and then you can lend at it again, but if you are a bank, you can take that $1 billion, use it to capitalize your bank, and then you can technically lend out 10 times that much. Or typically they do like 7 times as much. So instead of making 3%, you can make 73% or 21% on the same money, and you can increase the credit available in your community. So let's say you could make those loans at 2%, let's say. So you're giving the borrowers a good deal, cutting their interest rate down by a third, and you're still making 7 times 2 is 14% yourself, a lot more than you were making with the 3%. So that's the way banking works.
Somebody's making noises, breathing, coughing, snorting noises in the background. If you could mute yourself, please. Back to you, Ellen.
Okay, so, sorry, I lost my train of thought. So anyway, my first book on this subject was called Web of Debt, and it came out in 2007, before the crisis. Actually, I predicted the crisis, but it wasn't just me. I mean, I was just drawing on a lot of people I was quoting. And at that time, I thought this was shocking. And it was basically about how banks create our money. But the more I thought about it, I realized it's actually not a bad system. It's actually a good system to be able to monetize our own credit. If you went to the grocery store, and you tried to pay with your IOU, the grocer would take it because he doesn't know you, and he doesn't know where to find you. He doesn't know if you're good for the money. But you can go to the bank, and the bank will take your IOU, and the grocer will take the bank's IOU because the bank does know where to find you. They'll take some collateral or whatever. They have ways of making sure they get paid, and they're going to get some interest off it, so it's profitable for them. So it's not actually a bad system. We need that credit. If you only dealt in gold or you only dealt in Bitcoin, you would quickly fall into deflation and depression because there wouldn't be enough money to pay off all the debt we have. So it's a good system, I would say, but we need to own the banks. In other words, it's a good system if banks are a public utility that are actually creating credit like monetizing our own credit, and the profits from all that go back to the people.
But what would it take to do that? What would it take for California, well, this, the Los Angeles City Council, what would it take for them to start a public bank?
Well, and technically, in California, it only takes $20 million to start a bank. And, of course, the state of California is now, they have a task force that's been going since February to John Chung, the state treasurer, is in at the head of it. So what they're looking at, the feasibility of a state-owned bank to handle the marijuana, specifically because they're concerned about the marijuana money.
Going on in the background here, please.
Paul, you got to mute. Yes.
Right now, there are people toting big bags of cash around, or they've got cash stashed in their basements, and they have to drive with armored cars to go pay their taxes. So there's that, the safety feature. But there's also the fact that they're anticipating a $7 billion cannabis business, of which they will get taxes. State of California will get $1 billion in taxes. So, of course, they want to keep track of that money. So that's one of the motives for this sudden wave of new interest in publicly owned banks. But they're popping up everywhere, these groups or legislation to form state-owned banks or city-owned banks. So L.A. is doing it and the state of California. And L.A. also was prompted by the marijuana issue, the cannabis cash issue. Of course, it was just legalized in January of this year. And by the Wells Fargo problem, where the city council voted to pull their money out of Wells Fargo, as have a number of cities around the country. And then the question is, what do you do with the money? They've got too much money to put in a credit union or a local small bank. And we don't have any big, well, I guess arguably Wells Fargo is a big, I mean, is a Western bank, a local bank. But so the alternative is to put it in a Wall Street bank, which they are guilty of a litany litany of fraud. So you're not going to fix the problem. I mean, you go to all this trouble in moving your money, and you're still stuck with it.
You're saying only $20 million. For God's sakes, why don't we just do it?
Yeah, but with $20 million, you wouldn't have a real big bank. I mean, you want a bank big enough to take the state's money, so it has to be a bigger bank. I agree. Why not do it? They've got the money. There are many different ways you can slice it. But we've been arguing about this for 6 years now in different fronts, and we tend to lose these things eventually because the bankers' lobby is very strong, and bureaucrats themselves or legislators are naturally resistant to change. I mean, it takes a big push to get them to stick their necks out and do anything that they perceive as risky. So you need either a big public movement, as they had in North Dakota, which is actually, we're growing a movement. I mean, more and more people are taking an interest in this. I just saw a little article by somebody in Seattle where they appeared for some city legislative event. I don't remember what it was, but they were there to promote public banking, and there were a number of other groups that were all recommending public banking that they didn't even realize were into the same thing. So they've now formed a coalition with these other groups. They weren't specific about public banking. I think one was Black Lives Matter. Affordable housing issue, the homelessness issue, the student debt issue. There are many issues that could be addressed or at least helped by publicly owned banks.
You know, Ellen,
so we need a big popular push, which means, first of all, people have to know what we're talking about. Up till I started writing about it, I think people had never heard of publicly owned banks. I mean, they had, ordinary people that aren't specialists in the field.
Right.
And they hadn't heard of the Bank of North Dakota. I think the Bank of North Dakota intentionally has kept a low profile because they don't want the feds coming in and changing the law and you know, making it difficult for them.
Wow. Wow, wow, wow. Ken, Sherry, Paul, any questions or comments about what Ellen is talking about here? Randy?
Ellen, I would like to say something. This is Sherry, Sherry St. Vincent. I was just, this is interesting. I was just looking at the North Dakota State Bank yesterday. Very interesting how they have stayed small, and they only will allow residents of North Dakota to be a member of their bank. And I also was looking at other state banks. Arkansas has the most state chartered banks of any state. And I'm wondering why that is. Why don't other states have as many state chartered banks?
Mm-hmm. Actually, the North Dakota has the most banks per capita of any state. Of course, they're a very small state. I think they're 1/14th the size of L.A., the city of L.A. But most states are losing their local banks partly because of regulations, or largely actually because of regulations. First, after 2001, they strengthened those the Patriot Act and the anti-terrorism regulations, where the Know Your Customer thing, where you have to go through massive paperwork, and you can get into a lot of trouble not for actually money laundering, but for failing to report properly, failing to follow all these rules. And the little banks just don't have the manpower, to the staff, to do that. So that was one. And then there was, in 2010, there was the Dodd-Frank Act, which imposed another layer of regulations. And then there was the Basel III, the Bank for International Settlements regulates banks globally. And Basel III increased the capital requirements. So that's the money they have to hold off the table, which cuts into their ability to make loans. So between all of those, they were either going bankrupt or they just weren't profitable, and they would wind up selling out to the big banks. So this act, the Dodd-Frank Act, which supposedly was sold to us as eliminating too big to fail, has actually created too big to fail by making those banks so big that they can't fail. I mean, they're protected in so many ways, and they're just eating up.
Well, you know who's the biggest one that can't fail is Merrill Lynch and Bank of America. Now that they've been merged together.
Right.
I have muted caller that is calling in from the area code 202. I don't know. I think it might be our plumber. There's just so much trash on your line. Please forgive me, but I had to mute you out of the call. Randy, any other questions that you have here? Any solutions that you guys see together about ways that we can hold? We've got the Queen of England. We're reporting to the Queen of England. We've got our electronic signatures being used all over the place. Where does somebody throw a wrench into this machinery? Either one of you answer.
If I could jump in, I mean, many years ago, before Bitcoin was really even getting off the ground, I remember being at a conference somewhere. It was kind of a survivalist, off-the-grid kind of conference, lots and lots of vendors. It was huge, and it was very actually exciting, lots of good foods. And anyway, there was some people there, and they were out of Colorado, and they were starting, their own currency, and they were doing it to get out of the banks and get out of this whole IRS clutch. And they were they had bills that you swapped between you. So if you needed the plumber, you used these bills. Now, you had to buy them with the Federal Reserve notes, but once you got them, then you were intertwined in the community, and it was really neat. And then, of course, Bitcoin and all these other things have taken off. It's just, I see this. I've known about this North Dakota bank for quite some time. I see what Ellen is talking about, what's happening there. You're in California, right? This is happening
right
in California? Okay, so, you know, it's people standing up and saying, okay, we see it for what it is. Now we're going to come up with alternatives. And the thing is we have very smart people. I've said it for years prior to Trump, saying, you know, is this the best that the people can throw up to leave this country, and then you watched it go into the toilet bowl for so many years. And they became parasitical. The government was very parasitical, still is. There's so much more to change with it. And the people realize it. And so this is just a great alternative. I think it's really neat, and I hope it takes off. And it would be something that I would be very interested in down the road, for sure.
And you know, Ellen, right. You mentioned Black Lives Matter. That's actually one of George Soros' groups that was used to create disruption.
Right, so I hope that's
what he meant. When you said that
all right,
George,
I'll watch myself on that.
He was paying like $300 a day to them, to the people there to be disruptive. And I understand that with the executive order, and I've got my fingers crossed that this is all true, because I keep hearing things, and then you go, is it true, is it not true, that all of these guys are having their accounts frozen for bad behavior, according to anybody attached with pedophilia, things of that nature. So that's an undercurrent that we haven't actually called out, and Paul is so good on that, but I think his line is the one that was causing a bunch of mischief. So I swear, every which direction, it's almost like you have to put on a gas mask, earplugs, blinders, because there's fluoride and stuff in the water that'll burn your eyes. Lead in the pipes, you know, oh, God, asbestos every place you look, fluoride. And then we're out in the country and we're told that our water, our groundwater is poisoned. And something like 170 million Americans are drinking groundwater with some kind of inappropriate atomic particles in it, you know?
And don't forget the chemtrails.
Oh, how right. could anybody
and
forget the chemtrails? I actually
that are
thought.
Highly suspicious.
Okay, here's the problem I've got with all this stuff. This is Ken. If we live in a country that we're supposed to have freedoms, that we're supposed to make our own choices, pursue happiness, so on and so forth. If I make a mistake and I screw up financially, if I finance something without proper due diligence, and I just, you know, my eyes are bigger than my stomach, and I make a mistake, Then I rightfully should have to pay the consequences for that. But the problem is, and this is the problem that began with the OCC deregulation. The problem is when somebody else makes a mistake, when somebody else faults you, when a bank faults your credit and nixes your credit. Well, of course, when your credit's nixed, it changes your life. It can have a profound impact on your life, actually, more than just a credit report. And so what you have here is you've got a situation where the consumers were put into a situation where banks were coming in and ruining their credit. And once your credit's ruined, the banks have control of that. Well, of course, that's higher interest rates for them, and it's more difficult for you, of course, and your cost of living goes up. And that's the problems I see it is that we've got a system here where there's no protections for the consumers whatsoever anymore, because the court system is acting in admiralty and it's not a court of justice, and so there's nowhere for consumers to turn to get any kind of remedies whatsoever. And this has been going on for what, 20 years now, and I think people are finally starting to wake up and say, wait a second here, something's going on here. I'm not getting anywhere in life. I'm not getting raises. You know, the job situation is not getting any better. But yet you look around, and I'm looking around now, and I see construction booming right now. And I'm wondering to myself, where the hell are people getting the money to buy these properties? Well, they're not. They're firing up this no money down situation again and setting up this next collapse so that they can get a next group of people in to bleed all their assets from, because they're done with the people from 2008 and they need a new batch. And that's what I see happening here. The banking system, we've got to become more aware of what's going on and how banking operates. And it's not operating like it's back after World War II with our folks. It's a whole different system. And it's all operating on these electronic signatures, electronic transfers, all these mechanisms of control, to which people have no control to fix themselves or to get any kind of remedy or get ahead.
Yeah, and I've got a question for you, because I was remembering when I signed court papers and I could do it electronically, and I think I don't remember, but maybe it was a /S/
or something of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
Would that have been correct?
Yeah, well, actually, that's the way that these attorneys are signing all these documents, and patents and trademarks is signing documents that way.
And the deal is anybody can do that, so it doesn't mean a darn thing, and it doesn't identify anyone.
Well, no, that's the problem. I mean, who's to say whose signature is whose? And that's the problem here. The way that they're looking at it is, okay, under eSign, if you signed a mortgage loan back in 2005, and you get foreclosed upon in 2010, 2012, what they're doing is they're looking back to the original signature, and they're saying, well, you know, we've got an electronic record here that you signed way back in 2005, and we're going to hold you to it. And we don't have any repudiation power because it's under the laws of eSign. When I signed my mortgage loan, I refused to electronic documents, electronic contracts. I said, well, you know, you get paper form, and I'll come back and sign the documents then. Well, it didn't matter. I came back, signed the documents in paper form. It didn't matter. They still converted it to an electronic signature. And once they do that, you have the power of attorney and this hidden power of attorney that is controlling you. And there's no repudiation for any of these things. So anytime if there's a transaction that was fraudulent or there was no fair play in it, there's nothing you can do about it. You can't go back and repudiate it. And that's the problem. So people are getting held to these transactions that are fraudulent, but they have no recourse whatsoever.
Ken, what is the statute of limitations on chasing somebody?
Well, on fraud, it's fraud has no statute of limitations. Has none.
Okay, well,
whatsoever.
Let's say that I haven't made a payment on my house since 2007 when I found out they'd already been paid.
Mm-hmm.
I think the statute of limitations should have run out on them even being able to pursue me.
Yeah, I thought it was actually 3 years, or 4 years. I forgot now.
It's really 3 years from
discovery.
When you uncover fraud. So, in other words, if I find out 7 years down the road that there was a fraudulent transaction or fraudulent signature somewhere along the line, and I wouldn't have been able to find it out under ordinary due diligence, then the fraud kicks back in again.
Right. Well, I haven't paid them since 2010, and I've been arguing fraud the whole time. And then they sold my house twice this year. I have refused to leave.
Yes. I haven't paid mine since 2008, and I'm still here because I fight it. Because I've from day one I said this is not a mortgage loan. This is a lease transaction. I'm the investor. Let's balance the books. Pull the books together and balance the books, because when you balance the books, it's going to show that I'm not a debtor. I'm never going to be a debtor. I'm always going to be the creditor.
So I'm
and that's
my
the purpose. That's the purpose of going into Treasury. Treasury is bonds that are either liquidated or they're converted to common stock, and going into Treasury pulls those books together and makes a demand to balance the books.
I and Randy and all the rest of us go into Treasury next week and start to create our own private bank for California. I love this, Ellen. Wouldn't we have enough money to do that with what you're saying?
Ellen, the problem with public banks, what are you running into as far as technologies are concerned?
How do you mean?
I mean, as far as the operation of a public bank, like this North Dakota Bank, how do they operate? I mean, they can't be tied in with Goldman Sachs, I would imagine, because if Goldman Sachs will eat them alive.
Right. Well, they actually get their liquidity from the Federal Home Loan Banks, which are a quasi-federal institution. I mean, virtually every bank belongs to it, and
mm-hmm.
it's semi-protected by the government, and it's very liquid, and that's what I mean, we haven't managed to get one set up, of course, but that's what I would recommend for a state-owned bank to do.
Well, I think since you're a Californian, you should put some attention here, especially since we're a sanctuary state now.
Right. Well, actually, I was at a presentation for our state lieutenant governor, Gavin Newsom, who's running for governor. And sorry, I just lost my train of thought. sorry, what was it you just said?
I don't know.
I know. Sorry.
Asking since early. We're a sanctuary state now.
Oh, right, right. Yeah. So we're like the sixth largest economy in the world, and we have a number of issues with the federal government. We really should be our own. We could be our own country. We could definitely set up our own banking system. We have a number of cities in the state that are looking at city-owned banks. You could have a state-owned bank that was the mini-Fed for the state, just as the Bank of North Dakota is for North Dakota. We could set up our own cryptocurrency, Calcoin. I mean, somebody proposed that and worked out a whole proposal for how it would work.
Yeah.
Where they could take the cannabis money, and we're a big enough state that we really don't need the rest of the country. They take more. The feds take more money from us than we take from them. And of course, we have like what 50% of the. I think it is 75% of the organic food and 50% of the produce, something like that.
Yeah, something like that. So, what do you think, Kim? Do you think we should all just link arms and go for L.A. City Bank? I mean, what? How big is L.A. compared to the rest of the world?
I see California, and I think California scares the hell out of me. It's one of those crooked states there is out there. From my perspective, from the perspective of financial services and how things operate, Silicon Valley, L.A., all these technologies came out of Silicon Valley. All these patents came out of Silicon Valley. When I hear California, I think of. The first thing that comes to my mind is the California Corporate Franchise Act, and I remember reading and going into this act and looking at it a couple of years ago, and I'm reading it, talking all about oil and oil stations and gas stations, and all of a sudden, boom! I get into real estate brokers and it starts going into real estate and housing and everything. I think, what the hell is housing doing in oil and gas franchises? And this is one of the ways that I see they're laundering money out of California and laundering it away from having to pay taxes on it, is they're making the conversion. So I see California, and Sherry lives in California. She can tell you experiences of California. I think California is one of the most crooked states there is. I think that the politicians are, by and large, all in the revenue streams. We know that the judges are in the revenue streams. There's got to be transparency. I mean, there's got to be all these things that be put on the table and discussed. I mean, we've got so much privatization going. Remember about 20 years ago, 10, 15 years ago, we were all clamoring about, you know, less government, less government. We want more privatization. Well, we got more privatization, except the people that are privatized, that took the privatization of the banks and the attorneys, and they left us with nothing. And so we're not privatized at all. We're all our assets are being taken off the books and privatized. Our identity is being taken off the books and privatized, and we're left standing naked with nothing. You know, it has to do with all these banking and financial services and the processes that they operate under. It's terrible. I think California is horrible. Texas is another one. Delaware is another one. Florida is another one.
Careful, you're going to name all of them soon.
No, there's a few in there that I wouldn't name, but I mean it really is. And when it comes down to real property and issues of that nature, it does come down to each individual state, what their titling is, what their land processes are, what their conveyances are, so on and so forth. But you know, by and large, banking is stateless. I mean, that's the way Merrill Lynch had established it. We operate in networks, and anytime we do anything, everything we do is online. And when we go online and transact, we're transacting in basically a stateless environment because there is no borders.
I get it. I totally get it. So, Ellen,
yes.
You're in charge of the world today, and you're in California. Where do we start?
Charge of the world. Actually, I don't think I'd want to be in charge of the world, but I think we have to start
where,
in our own community.
You were saying we could be a separate world.
Oh, right. California could be its own country. Sure.
Right. The California could be its own country. So here
yeah,
you are.
Well, the obvious problem is we don't want to get into a civil war. We saw what happened when other states tried to break away. So we would have to do it in some way that, issue our own currency as a cryptocurrency. The Constitution says forbids states from issuing bills of credit, which is considered paper money. But if you did a cryptocurrency, it wouldn't actually be paper money. We'd probably get sued say it was unconstitutional, we couldn't issue our own money. But that's where I would start. Start issuing your own money and start paying off. I mean, everybody's in debt. All governments are in debt. People are in debt. Businesses are in debt. Why? It's because of the whole business model of our banking system that banks create our money. They create 95% of the money supply. The other 5% is coins and dollar bills. And they require that you pay back over 30 years, two or three times.
You got 1 minute to actually tell everybody how they can get in touch with you, because we have just scooted into the last 2 minutes of the program.
Okay. So my website is ellenbrown.com, and the Public Banking Institute is at publicbankinginstitute.org, and we have a newsletter that you can sign up for there. And my books on this subject are called Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, and they're available on Amazon.
And she's now chairman of the board again. This program has been brought to you by Kirkgaard Intergalactic Media, our radio partners, CloningCompany.com, Happily200.com, HeavenIncorporated.com, Anna Von Reich, Dr. James Murphy, John Denver, Dr. Joel Wallach, Tippi Hedren, Carol Channing, Deepak Chopra, Ed Asner, Dennis Weaver, Larry Hagman, and Esther Williams, Admiral Eugene Carroll, Jane Goodall, and Jonathan Gredoff, Dennis Kucinich, Chris Burgard, Paul the Plumber, Terry Cole Whitaker, Sherry St. Vincent, Lonnie Hogan Miller, Sherry Sharifi Brown, Roger Stone, Anna Von Reitz, David R., descendant of King David, RandyShannon.com, Edward F. Group III, Shalene Nightingale, DrValerie.com, doctors all spelled out. Thanks to Paul C. Bragg for leaving us your daughter, Patricia, to continue your work. Big thanks to our team at Voice America, Jess Bernard, our producer, Ryan Treasure, Randy Jackman, and our friends at Cumulus Radio, Mike Vitale, Mary Flynn, and Ron Simon, and our research director, Ron Hayes, and Ron Rocks. John Young at Totally Gospel, a big thanks for all the airtime and friendship you have given us over the years. We also want to thank Guelph, Ontario and Buffalo, New York for giving us a real boost in our listening audience and possibility. Merci beaucoup to Bent Migan for our theme music, Almost Ordinary People, which is available to you as a free MP3. Next week, invite a friend to listen. Be kind to yourself and someone else and think public banking. Think how do we undo signatures? Think, pay attention to Ken Dost and Ellen Brown. Check them out on Facebook. Randy Shannon. Thanks, everyone. It's been great today.
We're almost ordinary people with extraordinary plans. Almost ordinary people. And you're not crazy anymore.
Thank you for joining us today for Waking Up in America with Valerie Kirkgaard. Waking Up in America can be heard live every Wednesday on voiceamerica.com, and Valerie welcomes all emails at heavenincorporated.com.
This is for all in you, pouring through. Now your heart is open.